This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a new edition of a book about grieving.
Especially when I was in the throes of my own grief, being able to have the words on paper and look at them and say, yes, that's how I'm feeling. It's almost like you've got someone else there who is telling you that they understand.
Also, we'll learn more about the Community Foundation San Luis Obispo County.
And so we started a small grants program called Build, and that's only for organizations that have operating budgets of less than $500,000.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 3rd, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. It's been another dry year in California. Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a drought emergency in two northern California counties, and the Sierra snowpack is well below normal. Fire crews in the Santa Cruz Mountains and in the East Bay battled blazes yesterday as much of Northern California was warned that low humidity and strong winds were creating critical fire dangers. All that does not bode well for this summer's wildfire season. Here's KAZU's Doug McKnight.
To get a sense of what to expect this year, I spoke with CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Isaac Sanchez by phone from Sacramento. He says this year's lack of rain is
concerning. It's always concerning when we don't get the normal amount of precipitation that we expect, because that's part of the cycle. The rain that we receive is part of the cycle. It helps to bolster the vegetation that's out there to get it through the dry portions of the year so that it survives longer and is potentially less likely to burn and lead to a catastrophic fire.
You say it's part of your concern. What are the other things you're concerned about?
Ignitions, you know, preparation steps that the public can take. There's a whole laundry list of things that lead to, in my word, concerns. Preparations like fuel reduction projects that are pretty much year-round at this point. They never stop in different parts of the state. You know, preparation for our firefighters, making sure they're trained, funding, budgetary issues. It's a constant battle that simply doesn't start and stop with the burn conditions.
You talked about funding. How are you situated funding-wise for the new fire season coming up?
The governor did augment our funding, which allowed us to, this point, begin hiring firefighters sooner than we normally would have brought them back on, seasonal firefighters. There's funding for additional seasonal firefighters, additional positions. It's funding for our cooperative agreements to staff the California National Guard hand crews and California Conservation Corps hand crews.
Yeah, so you have the money. Are there people, are there firefighters in the state that are available to use during the fire season, or are you concerned you may run short of people?
No, we feel like we have an adequate amount or a reasonable amount as far as CAL FIRE is concerned. But, you know, you got to recognize also that, you know, we don't do this alone. This is a state that readily shares resources across jurisdictional boundaries. The simple fact is there is no fire department, there is no agency, single agency, that has the ability to do it alone. And we rely heavily, just like everybody else does, on the mutual aid system that exists here in the state.
Given so much of the state was on fire last year, are there particular areas in California that you're most concerned about this year?
If we kind of paint it in the light of the low snowpack, it's ultimately going to be places like the mid and upper elevations that rely on that precipitation and that snow that are going to dry out sooner. There's other places of the state that are just simply dry all the time. But overall, I wouldn't say that there's a single place that we're concerned about. It's going to be anywhere that's affected by this low precipitation, which is almost the entire state.
So for those people who live in areas that were hit last year, should they consider themselves to be safe? It's already been burned out?
Boy, I wish it worked that way. I really do, because, you know, those impacted communities really went through a lot last year, and the sad reality of our state and the way vegetation fires burn and the way the fuel regrows afterward is that danger can return almost immediately. The grasses will return first. Those grasses live and they die. They begin to die this time of year. They're going to continue to die, and then they're just going to be out there until either they're physically removed or they burn again. So, no, I wish most of those communities were able to be free from the threat of vegetation fires, but the sad reality is that they're not, and that kind of speaks to the importance of maintaining that vigilance and constantly being prepared.
That was KAZU's Doug McKnight speaking with CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Isaac Sanchez. And while wildfires can begin anytime in California, the traditional start of the wildfire season was Saturday, May 1st. Throughout San Luis Obispo County, local artists have been performing and workshopping their poems. As part of KCBX's Arts Beat, contributor Michael Barros has more.
Local poets have been sharing their writings in workshops, on small stages, and in Zoom calls. I spoke with several local poets about what the art form means to them and what role it plays in their lives. Marianne Anderson is a local who frequently attends writing workshops in Cambria with other artists.
We sit in front of the TV screen, late night channel surfing, eyes glossy, half a beer resting on the coffee table, our fingers entwined like knotted oak limbs.
That was an excerpt from Anderson's poem titled Sports Deprived that she wrote during the pandemic. She says poetry fulfills her spiritually.
Poetry has sort of been my altar of peace. It's where I go to pray out loud, to pray with words. It's a quiet place. It's a safe place. It's a holy place.
Anderson says she's often inspired by her surrounding environment.
And I love being in Cambria because we're in such gorgeous nature. I feel very, very attached and connected to it.
Anderson says her art has been keeping her calm throughout the pandemic and is giving her a sense of community. She released a new poetry book in January titled Before the After, Love, Loss, and Revolution in the Time of COVID.
The artist in any form, poetry, art, painting, dance, has an innate responsibility to be the mirror of what's happening in the world.
Dresden Smith is a recent Cal Poly graduate who grew up in Slo County. She says writing poetry helps her with her mental health.
I started writing poetry when I was actually super, super depressed. Being at Cal Poly was really, really hard for me. I did not feel supported or like I fit in at the university. Just being not only a person of color, but a Black person and a person with multiracial identities.
Smith says she felt she didn't really fit into any of the boxes that were available at Cal Poly or the world in general. And she was finding herself going through changes, finding and losing friends.
Through those things, I was very out of touch with who I was meant to be or who I felt like I should be. And poetry was really a way for me to express that sadness and anxiety, but in a way that felt productive and positive.
Smith says the act of writing poetry was a grounding and introspective act for her.
It's always been a way for me to express the way that I'm feeling inside my body, really, rather than my thoughts, but aligning those bodily feelings with my thoughts through writing, through poetry. And I've always thought like the power of poetry for me is to pour these feelings that I couldn't quite like pin down into words.
Kevin Patrick Sullivan is very involved in the arts community in Slo County. Among other roles, he's the co-founder and director of the annual San Luis Obispo Poetry Festival. He was also the co-founder and director of Corners of the Mouth, a monthly poetry series at Linnaeus Cafe that ran for 35 years. Sullivan says many of his poems are about environmental justice and says poets can use their work to awaken others.
Every poem written is against the machine because it is an act of resistance. It's because they try and take you make you conform.
For the rest of the year, poetry events are scheduled several times a month in San Luis Obispo County, with many moved to Zoom format, including Zoom readings based in Morro Bay and Los Osos. There are also in-person open mic readings at Kin Coffee in downtown San Luis Obispo. To connect with other poets or learn more about poetry events in Slo County, you can visit penciledin.com/calendar or languageofthesoul.org. For KCBX News, I'm Michael Barros.
The KCBX Arts Beat is made possible by a grant from the Community Foundation, San Luis Obispo County. There are many ways of expressing grief, and some find solace in writing. There's a new edition out of the book Voices of the Grieving Heart. And in this collection of selected pieces, 40 writers share their journeys through loss, grief, transformation, and healing.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Mike Bernhardt, writer and editor, in this case of a new edition of Voices of the Grieving Heart, first published in 1994. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you came from and so forth, but also events in your life that led to the publication of the first edition of the book in 94?
Sure. So I was married in 1983 to a woman who had a congenital heart condition, and she died in 1991. I was an electrician at that time, just sort of struggling to make it financially and stuff. And I was just, of course, devastated. And I had been keeping journals and doing a little bit of writing before that. So when she died, it was kind of natural for me to turn to writing just to express my grief in some way. And at a certain point, I started to want to read what other people had to say about their own grief. And I didn't really find anything that moved me. So I started looking for other people's poetry through solicitations in various newsletters, and was surprised to receive hundreds of responses of poems, and that was by mail at that time. And I ended up collecting them into the first edition of Voices of the Grieving Heart. During that process, I remarried and had a son, started a new career. In 2016, I retired, started travel writing. And it just last year with the pandemic, it just became clear that I needed to put this book out again. And so I started working on it, got new submissions, and here we are.
So how did you let people know of what you were seeking?
Well, I put advertisements in the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross Center newsletter. That organization doesn't really exist anymore, but I got a lot of responses from that. There's a national organization called the Compassionate Friends, which supports people who've lost children, parents, siblings, and they also had a newsletter. And so I advertised there as well. And the internet for me at that time was America Online. And there was a writing group there that I also posted on. And I received some responses from that, including from the person who was leading that group.
So I'm very intrigued how you chose, I'm going to use a French word now, the métier of poetry to make this happen. What was the trigger for that for you?
You know, poetry, we often think of poetry as you described it, as those kind of inaccessible verses that we had to read in school and analyze. And, you know, when the teacher asks, what did the author mean? And why did they choose this particular metaphor? But poetry really is unique, at least in modern times, in that there are no rules. You don't have to have complete sentences. It's sort of the opposite of what one might think. Because I think in writing poetry, we struggle to find maybe rhymes. And I could count on one hand the number of poems in this book that rhyme. You don't have to worry about grammar. You don't have to capitalize I if you don't want to. You can do the E.E. Cummings thing. The point of this poetry is to just write what you're feeling, write what's in your heart. And that's very different. It kind of, writing poetry cuts through the inner critic that says that our writing isn't good enough. The point of it is that when I read these poems, or even when I read my own poems, and the poems that I have in this book are from the early 90s still, and because I'm not really dealing too much with grief anymore, I look at them and it becomes like a mirror for me. I can see what I was feeling. I can remember that. And especially when I was in the throes of my own grief, being able to have the words on paper and look at them and say, yes, that's how I'm feeling. It's almost like you've got someone else there who is telling you that they understand, and you can feel that they know where you are.
If it's okay with you, let's dive right in and have you read a couple or two or three of your favorites.
Sure. I think what I'm going to start with actually is a poem that was written by someone else named Mara Tytel Shade. This poem for me, when I received it back in the early 90s, it's like an invocation for the entire book. I just love this poem, and so I kind of set it apart from all of the others, and it's called Voices. Poetry born from the pain of grieving, inseparable from the pain of growing, death creating life. A flower blossoms from your fertilizer. Muse, brother, one and the same. Your spirit, ever present, gives me courage to write. We talk in the land of dreams. I rejoice, knowing you continue to live. Our poems a testimonial to your existence.
That's intense and beautiful, too. It gives me the shivers.
And I'd say a lot of the poems in this book are that way. But, you know, and the variety is, I can read you one that was about the morning that my wife died. And it's intense, I will say that. And I often, I'll just say, because I'm on audio only, I often find myself choking up when I read some of these poems, even though I've read them hundreds of times in some cases. It still gets me the same way it might get others. And then we can move to some slightly lighter fare.
Sure.
This one's called Sunday. Together, we survived the terrifying night of CPR and defibrillation, too many tubes and wires and doctors. My kisses on your forehead and your eyes kissing me back until your EKG exploded and they told me to leave. I sat outside in the hallway talking softly with you. In the morning, though your eyes seemed empty, I expected your recovery and went home to sleep, only to be greeted by a ringing phone and an urgent voice. And I was out again, stuck in traffic on the Bay Bridge, praying, screaming at God to get me to you in time. Hoping that curses and prayers might be enough, I inched and fought my way through traffic and despair until finally free, nearly drowning, I plunged into the streets, racing to San Francisco General. Sometimes now, I like to imagine what I would have told the police if they'd noticed. I like to think that I wouldn't have pulled over. I would have just plummeted on at 70 miles an hour up Potrero Avenue, letting them catch up to me in the parking lot as I ran inside. My wife's dying, I would have screamed. But they didn't notice. I ran inside alone to find my friends crying and you dead.
This is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Mike Bernhardt, writer and editor of a new edition of poems about grief and grieving, entitled Voices of the Grieving Heart. Do you have a poem, just out of curiosity, that is more light or more forgiving? Or
I do. I do want to say one quick thing about that poem, which
please,
is that I actually wrote it about a year after my first wife died. And what happened was I was kind of experiencing a bit of shock from time to time, where I actually feel dizzy and kind of woozy when I remembered the day that she died. And I mean, literally like putting my hands on the counter in the kitchen and having to kind of stop. It was that physical for me. And one day I was driving down the peninsula for something, and it was happening in the car. And I just told myself, put this aside. When I get home, I'm going to write about it. And so that's what I did. When I got home, I closed my eyes in front of the computer, my little Macintosh SE, and I sat down and I wrote out the poem. And the interesting thing was I never had that experience of shock again after I wrote down the poem. It was like it just had to come out. And once it was out, I was okay.
It's interesting that poetry, that ancient medium, is the go-to for this and for so many people. What are your thoughts about that?
I think especially in the U.S., you know, we want to fix things. It's just a cultural norm for us, which is good. And it's why America became a technological leader in the world and all of that stuff. But when someone loses a loved one, we don't know how to fix it. And it can be very hard for people to sit with pain. So, you know, we have, as you mentioned, we've got the Hallmark cards, and not bashing Hallmark by any means, but, you know, we have sympathy cards that say essentially, you know, yes, you're hurting now, but you'll see your loved one in heaven. So, you know, it'll all be okay. And it's not okay, as you well know. And what we really want is not to be told that we should feel better. What we want is to be in community with other people who understand our loss, especially people who've experienced it themselves. And I think that's the value of many of the rituals of funerals or sitting Shiva or even a wake, those sorts of things, is that we're in community with people who are just there to care for us. Yeah, so poetry is a way of, as I said, especially now in the pandemic, when it's so hard for people to gather. You know, there's a poem in here about going to a funeral on Zoom. In fact, there's a couple of them. One was a woman whose father was buried at Arlington National Cemetery. He had served in the Navy and was at the Battle of Iwo Jima. But because it was in Washington and she's here in San Francisco, she had to attend with her sister's iPhone showing her what was going on. And her poem was about wearing black and standing in her dining room watching the funeral.
Have you found a difference between how this concept is approached by men versus women?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I'd say the vast majority of the poems in this book are by women, but there certainly are men. And there's one poem in here that is by a man who found his 24-year-old son dead of an accidental overdose of some fentanyl pills that his son had gotten for back pain, but they were laced, you know, with something else. And he wrote just a heartbreaking poem about finding his son dead. And so I don't know if it's a matter of male versus female as much as it is just feeling comfortable expressing emotion. And that tends to be more of a female thing, but maybe it's just more of the feminine side that we all have, whether we're men or women.
Sure.
You know, if we're more comfortable with that, then we tend to be able to express emotions better.
How about some more poems?
Sure. I'll give you sort of the bookend to the other poem that I wrote, Sunday. This one I wrote a couple of years later, after I'd already met my second wife. We were engaged to be married at this point. And this one is called Time Passes. Bright red dragonfly hovers by my face, slips off and returns again and again. Cat watches with vague interest from his shaded lair under the patio table. Yvonne tends the flowers, picks a zucchini and strawberries for dinner. Life continues now as if you had never been here, though I am here because of you. Your death connected me forever to what lies beyond this world. I felt that light inside me always. Rudderless, beguiled, I longed to join it. But time passes. Yvonne is smiling at me. We talk of dreams and having children. This garden is exploding with life, and I am no longer in any hurry to leave.
That's just absolutely lovely. If you don't mind, and as we get towards the end here, I want to read a sentence that you sent me earlier in our correspondence, and this is you quoted. When we read or write a poem that speaks honestly of our own experience, it's like holding a mirror in which we see ourselves and our pain in a new way. The purpose of the book is to help people explore their grief in a way that might find their own answers rather than being told what to think or feel. Any parting thoughts?
That is the purpose of this book. It's really just to, it's not a book that's intended necessarily for reading cover to cover. There is a huge range of different experiences in this book. I don't like to call them stages of grief. I prefer to call them aspects. And depending where you are, different poems may speak to you on different days or different hours. And so the idea of it is that you can find poems that will express how you feel when you don't have the words to express it yourself.
This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Mike Bernhardt, writer and editor of the new edition of the book, Voices of the Grieving Heart. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much, Brian.
There's a new social media celebrity from the Santa Barbara Zoo. Monty is a penguin, a Humboldt penguin, and he's been cruising the zoo to visit the other animals during the pandemic. Now there's a children's book about him. Contributor Beth Thornton talked with author Dori Edwards, who wrote Monty's Marvelous Adventures.
So they soon will be molting when they lose all their feathers.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm at the Santa Barbara Zoo to learn more about Monty the Humboldt penguin and to meet author Dori Edwards. My name is Dory Edwards. I am the content creator at the Santa Barbara Zoo. So that means I run all of the social media streams, the Instagram, Facebook, and that includes taking the photographs for that, creating the videos for it, and then writing all the copy as well. So
you have very successfully created a media sensation.
Thank you.
Monty, I believe, has thousands of followers. How did the idea for a book about Monty come about?
Well, I started at the zoo in December of 2019, just a few months before the pandemic hit. And so, you know, start this job, really excited about it, and then it closes down. It's empty. And so we reached out to some of the keepers to see if they had any fun ideas, you know, that could continue to engage the community while the zoo is closed. And Keeper Ellie, who worked with Monty when he was a baby, was like, well, I haven't brought him out in a while. Let's just bring him out. He can meet Honeybun the rabbit. And so we took him to meet the rabbit, and he was having so much fun. Then we're like, okay, well, let's take him to see Bangori the gorilla. And didn't expect a lot out of it. It's like, okay, let's share this adventure. And I was like, I'll turn it into a series, like not just one video. Let's follow him every day, see where he goes. And it just took off. People fell in love with him and his personality, his connection with Ellie, his curiosity. And as his audience continued to grow, his Monty's community, people started commenting, does he have a book? And it was like, no, but I have the time and I love to write. And I felt so connected to him in this story that I was like, you know what, it deserves to be told.
Have you written other books?
No, I've always loved to write, but never written a book till now.
I think that the book is part of a fundraising effort. Do all the proceeds go to the zoo? Yep.
Every single dollar cent made goes to the zoo and the animals and their conservation and their care.
Tell us about the story of Monty's marvelous adventures.
Yes.
What is the message?
The message to me is, you know, when we are curious, when we take a look at the world with wonderment in our eyes and accept those around us, that everyone is different. But really at the root, we all just have a beautiful heart and are trying to our best to go through this life as we are.
Just to describe it for our listeners,
yeah.
Monty goes out on walks, free walks. He's not on a leash or anything, and visits the other animals.
Yes.
And through the story, you take us from one animal visit to another.
Yes.
And he discovers, what does he discover along the way?
He discovers along the way that there are so many creatures very different from him in this world. You know, there is Michael the giraffe, who is so tall compared to Monty's. You know, he barely comes up to my knees and I'm 5'2". there's this tall being that he doesn't have the same quality as. He's small, or he is small compared to Bangori the gorilla, who has this great might, and realizing still that he is perfect just the way he is for his environment. You know, his size makes him able to swim really fast and catch a lot of fish. And, you know, he's perfect as he is.
You observed Monty. Were you here at the zoo and able to observe him?
Yes. So I would come on site, you know, when I needed content. I would schedule times with Ellie and Dana, his other keeper, to meet with Monty and take him on an adventure. And so all the photos, the videos that you see of Monty, that was me behind the camera, able to follow him around and whatever he was doing. So I did really get to just be with him and experience his beauty.
What has been the reaction to the book?
It's been so humbling, and I feel so grateful for this community that has been built for this being, Monty, who has brought so much joy to people in a time where there's so much difficulty, we're facing so much grief, and here is this penguin that's come along to bring everyone smiles, you know, and the love between him and Ellie, and having people receive the book and they tag us on Instagram and share how much they appreciate being able to bring him home and spread this message and learn with their kids and their family. And
do you think that being in the pandemic has made people really seek out stories like Monty's?
Definitely, definitely. I think, you know, we are missing a lot of connection that we're used to. And I think that we are a communal species, that we do share the earth. And so seeking out these stories that are bringing us joy and connection in a time that can feel isolating is so important.
How closely did you work with the illustrator? Very closely. His name is Ryan Carr, and he's just a wonderful, kind human being. And I found him through my dad. He was actually a great friend of my dad's who illustrated one of my childhood dogs years ago. And I reached out to him, and he was just so excited. And I felt immediately like he believed in the story, which just felt so good because the community believes in Monty and his story. And so, yeah, he came to the zoo and he met Monty and then spent the day getting to know all the other animals that are in the story. And I just feel like he captured their personality so well, like their real beauty and their quirks and their personalities and what they can all teach us.
I agree.
Thank you.
This is a conversation with author Dori Edwards at the Santa Barbara Zoo.
It's about Monty as an adult penguin touring the zoo. But do you know that Monty's story as a baby?
I know most of it. I don't know some of the small details, but he was born sick. Basically, he would not survive without human care. And Ellie and a few other keepers helped to provide him with that care. And I learned that Monty is actually the first animal that Ellie cared for when she came here to the zoo, which is great. And so now that's why they have that bond. So the scars on his back that are referenced in the book are from antibiotic injections that he needed to survive. And so his feathers and skin haven't healed completely.
And the human care maybe explains his willingness to be around humans.
Yes.
And to actually enjoy that human contact.
Yes, Monty is particularly comfortable with humans.
The animals that you chose to have Monty visit in the book,
yes.
Are those some of his favorite spots to visit, or are those chosen as favorites of the people who come to the zoo?
I would say yes to both, but the main was they were actually based on his actual encounters. So Bangori, the gorilla, was one of the first animals he encountered, and that was, I think, really the video that kind of sent him off, made him viral, because it's him on the other side of the glass from Bangori, and just the way they look at each other with this kind of mutual curiosity and respect. It was so amazing to see. So it's based off of that. And then the tortoise and the giraffe are actually related. We took him to view the tortoises up top near the giraffes, and he went in and like nibbled on their shell a little bit. And we didn't even think about that Michael's so tall, he could just reach over. So while Monty was visiting the tortoises, Michael's a giraffe. We turn around and Michael's just had this shocked look on his face, like, what is this creature, you know? And so those three were, I would say, the most popular videos, had the biggest interaction, and just kind of the most unique story. And so I took those. And
how did Monty change the social media audience for the zoo? Did you start with a few thousand and suddenly you saw this jump when Monty made his appearance?
Oh, definitely. So when I started at the zoo, we had about 35,000 followers. We're now at 70,000 a year later, which has doubled. And our engagement, our comments have just skyrocketed. And it largely was due to Monty, because there was this engagement. It started a conversation. It started a community, you know, so people wanted to show up and see how Monty was doing today, you know, and what could he teach them. And so
they probably told their friends.
Exactly. And they told their friends and their kids. And it just became this movement, you know, to see the joy of a penguin. And so it was really about the conversation and the community building.
My final question for you has to do with how this project has been for you to write about Monty.
I feel so utterly grateful that I get to be here and that I have a friend that's a penguin that knows my voice. You know, I'm like, I think I could die happy. That I get to be around people like Ellie and the zoo who care about animals so much, you know, that this is why we are here, for conservation, to bring connection to people, because when we connect to something, then we want to care for it and protect it.
That was Dori Edwards, author of Monty's Marvelous Adventures. Find out more at sbzoo.org. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
Working Lunch is the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's series where they connect you with people in the community. Your host, Jim D'Antona, is president and CEO of the SLO Chamber.
Welcome to Working Lunch. Today, we're sitting down with Heidi McPherson, CEO of the Community Foundation San Luis Obispo County. The Community Foundation is a grant-making and education foundation supporting charitable work across our county with grants and scholarships totaling more than $37 million. Since 2014, Heidi has led the organization's work to fulfill their vision of improving the lives for all who live and care about Sloan County's diverse communities. Under her stewardship, the foundation's grants program has positively impacted lives of thousands, and the charitable assets have grown more than 20%. Heidi has been recognized as an outstanding community leader with accolades from the American Association of University Women, March of Dimes Women of Achievement, the State of Pennsylvania Senate, and as a top 50 women in business on the Central Coast by the Pacific Coast Business Times for 4 years. Her diverse experience includes senior management and consulting roles for community foundations, private family foundations, as well as universities, and health, social justice, and arts organizations. Today, I'm excited to talk with Heidi about what led to a career in philanthropy, how local nonprofits are adapting in the pandemic, and some of the amazing work being done at the Community Foundation. Heidi, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Jim. Delighted to join you.
I'd love to know what first drew you to a career in philanthropy. Was there an event, an experience, something that shaped your philanthropic values?
It's such an interesting question because back in the day, nobody really thought they were actually going to get into the business of philanthropy. And I was actually on my way to law school and as an undergraduate, and I was elected to the board of trustees of my college and got involved in the anti-apartheid movement, trying to divest the university from investments in South Africa. And I found this incredible passion for the work. And so I think that just kind of got me started. I never went to law school. I got into philanthropy for social change, and the rest is history.
Is there an accomplishment or an endeavor that you're particularly proud of?
I think, to be honest, the thing that I'm most excited about in my career is what we've done most recently with the Disaster Support Fund at the foundation during COVID, to really see a community come together to support one another, and the fact that the Community Foundation is here so that we can help people who want to help other people. It really is just an extraordinary demonstration about how philanthropy can impact social change.
What are some of your passions and hobbies? How would someone who knows you only outside of work maybe describe you?
Right now we have a new puppy at our house that we're training to be a therapy dog. And so I'm a little tired because of that. But to be honest, I bring my personal self and my professional self to the work because I so believe in it. And it's so fulfilling. And I think that's really important to me, both on the personal and professional side.
Yeah, I was going to wonder if that was part of what makes doing this work so great, is that some of your personal and professional kind of overlap in that area.
Yeah, you really have to bring your own personal values to this work because, there's the times that it really is very challenging and demanding, and you really need to draw on that deep well that you have, that you really believe in this work. And I think that it really is kind of a thrill, actually, professionally, to be able to marry your personal values with your professional endeavor. And I really feel, very fortunate to be able to realize both sides of myself.
So you obviously did not grow up in SLO, but what initially drew you to SLO then? Were you someone who had long visited the area, or was this role really kind of your first connection?
When we lived in Santa Monica, my husband had Cal Poly as a client. And so he used to come up here once or twice a year. And I was working at UCLA at the time. And he was saying, oh, you just got to come up to this wonderful little town, San Luis Obispo. And we'd gotten married in Santa Barbara. And so I came up with him once. This is years ago before the kids were born. And we just fell in love with it. But then the kids were born and we moved back east. And, that's where we're both from. And we raised our kids and the whole thing. But we always kind of kept in the back of our mind, we want to go back to California. And so when I was first approached by Dave Edwards, who was the very first executive for the Community Foundation, who when he left the Community Foundation was working in a search firm. And so he did the search for my position. And so when he called me to talk about this, and I thought, well, this is kind of odd. And so I called my husband at work and I said, I just got this odd phone call about a position in San Luis Obispo. And Dick said, well, I don't care what the job is, just say yes. So it was a little bit more complicated than that. But basically, we just always felt that this was a very, very special place. And we've been here for 7 years and it feels like home.
You mentioned that, you came from a small community where you knew everyone and everyone knew you back on the East Coast. And was that something you were looking to replicate in this role, or was that something completely not in the plan?
It's so interesting. And I think, you know, many of us have an experience of working professionally as an adult in an environment and a community where you grew up. And that was wonderful. And we loved it. And there are three generations of us, et cetera. But I think that there's a little bit of church and state, right? You want, you know, really want to be able to say, this is my professional life. This is my personal life. There's something nice about going to the grocery store and not having everybody talk to you about the Community Foundation business. Although I'm happy to always talk about the Community Foundation business. But I think I value my personal space now more than since I have that opportunity to kind of segment my life, you know, a little bit more. So, you know, I don't need to have everybody know me by any means. I want them to know the Community Foundation, but I am not the Community Foundation. The Community Foundation is its own entity. And so I think that separation between those two, the personal and the professional, is important for me.
You were talking about, you know, that experience of not wanting to develop an organization that kind of rests on the personality of the CEO. Was that something you encountered when you came here? And, you know, are there pros and cons to having that being the face or the complete organization around your personality?
The organization can't help but demonstrate your own, you know, personality and your own values. And I think that there's a nice marriage between, you know, my professional values and the Community Foundation's values. You know, integrity and diversity are very, very important to me and to the foundation. And so that marriage is really important. And, you know, the Community Foundation is a permanent entity and was here long before me and will be here long after me. And so I often tell our team at the foundation, it's our turn to watch it. It's our turn to steward this incredibly important organization that benefits the entire community. And so let's take good care, you know, while we can, you know, while it's our turn to pay attention and to be stewards of this wonderful, wonderful institution.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Heidi McPherson of the Community Foundation San Luis Obispo County is speaking with the Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona.
But it occurs to me, if someone has never encountered a community foundation before, maybe how would you describe the institution in general?
Yeah, community foundations are a unique beast, and they are really kind of like a public trust that, you know, as you said in your introduction, we're grant makers, we're educators, we, you know, work with people who are interested in philanthropy and to make a difference in their community, estate giving, professional advisors, donor advised funds, those kinds of things. But community foundations themselves have been around for a long time. And the first one is over 100 years old in Ohio. And, you know, we're coming up on 25 years, believe it or not, which is just amazing. And there are over 1,000 community foundations just in the United States. And so there's a really large and very rich network of professionals who work in this space. Each community foundation is kind of organic to its own community. So there are a lot of things that are very similar, but, you know, the uniqueness of the community and the Community Foundation representing that community. We look very different than the Orange County Community Foundation, for example. But I think that that's one of the joys of a community foundation is it came from the community itself. And so it represents what the personality is, you know, from our standpoint too. So, you know, we manage investments, we work with folks to be able to match their interests with the community needs. And then we work with all of our nonprofit partners as well across the county.
Could you talk a little bit about what's the personality or the culture of the Community Foundation in SLO and kind of where that ethos comes from or feels like?
Yeah, and I think it really comes from the founders of the Community Foundation. You know, why do we have a Community Foundation that serves our county? And I think that the sense that you and I both had since we come from other places, that we didn't know that much about the Central Coast until you really get to learn about it and then you love it. And I think that the fact that there were people, you know, 25 years ago, who said we need to keep philanthropy here and have a resource so the people who are interested in making a difference can have some place to talk to. We work with all of the nonprofits, all of the needs, all of the data. And I think that, so we are the trusted advisor for a lot of folks in what are the needs, what are the trends that we're seeing? Because we're on the ground working with the nonprofits, every day, pretty much, in terms of what their needs are. And with COVID, it's just been extraordinary. And I'm incredibly proud of the nonprofit community and how they've been able to pivot and respond. But part of that is because this is such a generous community that those values of caring about one another that this community is known for, it was just came through in the disaster and COVID. I think we just really saw the bright side of this community. There's so many bright sides from COVID. COVID's so dark that I like to think about the bright side and, what are the things that we've learned? What are some of the wonderful trends that we're going to see going forward? But I think those values started with the founders who decided that we really wanted to have a resource here locally to connect people with Q Care with the needs, and that catalyst and connector role is something that we take, very, very seriously.
Do you have data on how we actually stack up compared to maybe other communities in the region, in the state, in the country?
No, well, it's an interesting question. And I have to tell you, almost every community I've been in feels like they have the most nonprofits that anybody's ever seen. And so when I got here, I thought, well, if we're going to be a grant maker, a successful grant maker, I really need to have a better sense of who are the agencies that are out there. And so we actually did a study and used data that's collected by the IRS on tax returns, et cetera, to really look at how many nonprofits do we actually have? How large are they? And it's fascinating because we really don't have as many active nonprofits. So the ones that people can register as a nonprofit, but then they're not actually operating. So we have less nonprofits than people think. But what we do have is we have a lot of small nonprofits. And so about 80% of our nonprofits have budgets under $500,000. So that really helped us adjust our grant program so that we could really focus on how do we help those small organizations. So a little small organization whose executive is probably a volunteer or it's only one person and they're, at 10 o'clock at night trying to, jam out a grant application, and put that next to one of the large organizations that gets federal and state and county money. Those applications, you can't really compare apples to apples that way because they're really apples to oranges. And so we really started to determine that our grant program needed to separate a little bit. And so we started a small grants program called BUILD. And that's only for organizations that have operating budgets of less than $500,000. And it really is to help build capacity. And so that was really important for us. So we, we heard that myth and we really wanted some data around it, and we got the data. And as a result, our grants program is revised.
This has been a rough year. Is there something maybe the broader community should know about this past year for our nonprofits?
One of the things that we've really seen is twofold. One is, yes, the nonprofits are struggling. They're very much struggling. And this has hit them very hard because it's hit their clients and their patients and the people that they serve very hard. And so they've really had to scramble to be able to meet the needs of their constituencies. At the same time, it's been really hard to raise money. So I think that the nonprofits, I give them an enormous amount of credit for hanging in there and really facing the adversity as best they possibly can. And they've been just remarkable. One of the really bright spots, I think, is that that COVID has really demonstrated to us all, and specifically to the nonprofits, that they're stronger together. And so we're seeing some wonderful collaboration and cooperation, mergers, et cetera, of nonprofits who do similar work and realize that they are stronger together. And so I'm really excited about that level of collaboration.
If folks want to find out more, should they jump over to the website there and figure out how to get connected to some of these?
Absolutely. The website is the best place to check us out. And we also have a newsletter. People can sign up for the newsletter as well. And there's a way to do that on the website. So, give us a call, send us a line, jump on Facebook or the website.
Well, Heidi, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today and talk about all the great work that's happening with the Community Foundation. So wonderful of you to spend time with us. So we thank you.
Oh, sure. It's my pleasure. Thank you so much. I love this series that the Chamber does. So anything we can do to support you all, we're happy to do so.
That was the Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona speaking with Heidi McPherson of the Community Foundation San Luis Obispo County. You'll find their website at cfsloco.org. And finally, we'll head to Fort Hunter Liggett, where an 80th anniversary open house is planned for later this month.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County. Come along and join me as we visit with Major Loft.
Good afternoon.
So, here we are, 80 years later.
The installation was founded in 1941, land that was owned by William Randolph Hearst. And as the nation built up for World War II, it needed area training in this part of the States. There's some stories out there of how this place came to be, and you know, there were some tax issues with the Hearsts, and gave the land to the United States, the government, in order to settle those tax debts. And Fort Hunter Liggett was born, named after a World War I general. He was the chief of staff to General Pershing, General Hunter Liggett.
Over the years at Fort Hunter Liggett, there have been a lot of different iterations. And one of the things I was told, going back to the 70s, to the Vietnam era, this was a very important training base where they problem solved. Things like night vision goggles were developed here.
This was a big proving ground, essentially. And today we still have proving grounds in other parts of the country. But, you know, concepts were developed, then put into practice here at Hunter Liggett. How remote it is and unencroached throughout the area. It was a great testing area for the Apache helicopter. A couple of the Marine Corps vehicles were tested out here as well. Just met with a sergeant major today who was stationed here in the 80s, who was part of the testing command that was here. You know, he said that a lot has changed since, you know, he hadn't been here in a number of years, and a lot has changed. But this place was great for that. It provided the climate and the terrain to test all types of equipment.
And without disturbing the neighbors.
Right. Maybe a couple cows.
How many acres? It's like
165,000. It's the seventh largest Army installation in the United States.
And I think, isn't it the largest Army reserve?
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
In all of America?
Correct. So, yeah, we've got a lot of land out here. Everything from maneuvers with vehicles to dismounted infantry maneuvers to airborne, parachute. We can do just about everything.
You have a lot of diversity of training schools here.
Correct. This is a huge training platform for institutional training and teaching soldiers initial skills in their new jobs. With an MOS, a military occupation specialty, we train 13 separate MOS schools here. Big focus on engineer and military police. And then we also have, for enlisted soldiers, the non-commissioned officer corps, they go through a lot of their professional military education here. We teach the 13 jobs, and then we teach 7 professional military education courses for our non-commissioned officers.
A year or so ago, I remember attending the opening ceremonies for your schoolhouse, which is super high-tech.
Right. And so those classes I just talked about, that's where those classes are taught. Right now, in a COVID world, they're really operating about a half capacity over there. But once we get through this, they're ready to just ramp up. And they do. It's a state-of-the-art building. We really like to show it off anytime we have people come out. Matter of fact, for our 80th anniversary, the commander for that school will be here as we dedicate it to a World War II Medal of Honor recipient.
That's so cool. So you have different events that are celebrating the 80th.
Right. The 80th anniversary, the actual date was in January. So January 10th, 1941 is when Fort Hunter Liggett was established. So on May 15th, which is Armed Forces Day, we are celebrating our 80th anniversary.
And this is an open house to the public, right?
It is. We're just asking that you have a valid identification to come onto the installation, come out and enjoy it. It's not often we get to do this, given some challenges that we face in the world today. We want everyone to come out and see what we see on a daily basis and to have fun. We have things here that we want to share with the community.
You have some cool things, like one, I hope I can make it. You have a World War II C-47 DC-3 that's going to fly in. That's
right.
Really
the,
cool.
The best part about that is that it's going to land on a dirt airstrip. You know, we will kick up a little dust. We really think that that's going to be a huge draw for the public to come and see.
And a couple other events, highlights would be some of your military displays.
Actually, where the aircraft is going to land, we're also going to have a Coast Guard helicopter. We're supporting all aspects of the military here. All branches train. So it's not just an Army event. We're going to have Coast Guard. We're going to have the Marine Corps. We're going to have the Army, obviously. We're hoping that the Navy still gets here. They come here to train all the time, so they're clearly invited. But we're going to have vehicles set up so people can come out and get photos with vehicles, interact with soldiers that operate these vehicles, get to learn a little bit about them.
And then you have, out of sight, your high-tech virtual reality training laboratories. And I understand there's going to be an open house there.
Correct. And that's going to provide everyone the opportunity to go through and fire a simulated M4 rifles or M9 pistols, machine guns. And what these do is that it's very realistic without the enormous expense of firing these weapons.
I imagine just the cost saving in bullets. I mean, 150 caliber is what, probably $5 a round or something.
Right. And now this also gets soldiers comfortable when they go out to fire their weapons on the range for real. It prepares them better.
Dig a little deeper on the events taking place on May 15th at Fort Hunter Lake.
Throughout the installation, we're going to have various areas open to the public, starting with our chapel, where we have our chaplains and our religious support office. They provide ministry to soldiers that are here for training and that also live here on the installation. They're going to have their facility open for folks to come and walk through. As you enter the installation, you're going to come past our track and field area, which is a state-of-the-art track. It's really one of the nicest things we have here. And one of our units on the installation, the 91st Training Division, is going to be demonstrating our newest physical fitness test, the Army Combat Fitness Test. It's replacing the Army Physical Fitness Test, which for over 30 years has been the test that every soldier has taken to measure their physical fitness. So it's a much more complicated test, but it's a bigger holistic picture of someone's overall fitness. So that's going to be on display. We'll have our gym, which is right across the street. That'll be open for folks to walk through. Our newly renovated pool, which some folks may think it's a swimming pool for fun. It's actually a training pool where we do a variety of, you know, water-based training exercises. We're going to have a barracks building that's going to be opened.
Again, under the radar, I understand that you guys got most cutting-edge barracks in America.
Right, and these barracks are for folks that may have served some time in the military years ago, where we had the open bay barracks and soldiers on bunks. Now, we still have those, but we also have, you know, some single rooms in there.
They get real beds now?
Real beds. The barracks have wireless internet in them now for soldiers. They also have small kitchens, very nice state-of-the-art restrooms, latrine facilities, so when soldiers get done working out, they can get a shower and get right back to work.
And walking distance to the schoolhouse.
And the school and the dining facility, so the soldiers can get something to eat.
A little bit more on the diversity of activities and things people could see and do.
Sure. Again, we talked about the simulators already. People will be able to come through and see those. But really, the jewel of the installation is the Hacienda.
Tell us the backstory on Hacienda.
So the Hacienda, designed by Julia Morgan, who also designed the Hearst Castle. Really, every event that we have here is really held at the Hacienda. From just the beauty of it, the historical nature of it, everyone that comes here wants to see that. So a lot of our events are going to be held up there. We're going to have an opening ceremony there shortly after 11 o'clock. We'll have the 91st Training Division is going to be firing off cannons.
Nice.
We're going to have the national anthem will be played. And we're going to have the opening ceremony. We're going to have numerous general officers that are serving today speak. We're going to have some local elected officials speaking. Some nationally elected officials from California will also be there. One of the biggest things we're going to have that morning shortly after the opening ceremony is we're going to have a future service member swear in. Now, I had the opportunity to do one of these a couple years ago while I was in recruiting command. These are really great because you take young men and women who have recently enlisted into the military. Again, not just the Army, but also we're going to have the Marine Corps represented. And they're going to raise their right hands and they're going to recite the Oath of Enlistment. The Oath of Enlistment is going to be provided by our senior commander, Major General Resende. There's going to be other general officers there with him that will recite that oath of enlistment for all these future service members. And one of the best things about this is, since COVID has happened, when a young man or woman enlists into today's military, it's a big ceremony at the entrance facility, the MEPS, as we call it. And families have not been able to witness their sons and daughters enlist. And we're going to have about 20 future Marines and 20 future soldiers here with their families. And their families are going to see them raise their right hand and swear allegiance to the United States and to the Constitution.
Once again, May 15th at Fort Hunter Liggett.
We're looking forward to it. Again, an open installation for the day. Please come out and enjoy it. It's a beautiful drive out here.
How many people are you expecting to show up?
We're hoping we get over 1,000 people to show up. You know, with COVID, there haven't been many events. And we've taken precautions to keep everyone safe. 98% of this event is outdoors. So we want everyone to come out and have a good time, but also be safe doing so.
For additional information, where would you direct somebody?
Just Google Fort Hunter Liggett. Our website will pop up. We have QR codes. information's readily available online.
Major Love, thank you so much for sharing. This is a great day on base.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.